Hello and welcome to another exciting edition of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host, Danny Lobel. Thank you very much for tuning into the show. Thanks for checking it out if you're new. Thank you for sticking with it if you've been with me for a while. And thanks for wavering back and forth if you're one of those kind of people who just tunes in every now and then and you can't commit. Even those people, I say thank you very much for the times that you're with me. Today's guest is somebody who's very special to me. Kelly Carlin, who has become one of my good friends since I've moved out to L.A., a huge support, probably a great majority of my support system here in L.A. since I have arrived. She's become a good friend of mine over the past few years. And her dad, George Carlin, was a good friend of mine and a huge influence on me, and he continues to be, and a huge part of the name of this show. In fact, this show would not be called Modern Day Philosophers had it not been for George Carlin, because the day that he died, I got a call from Jackie Mason, who had introduced us, and he said, George Carlin, he was more than even a comedian, he was a modern day philosopher. And that always stuck with me, and then every time I'd hear it, when people would refer to stand-up comedians as modern day philosophers, it always reminded me of George. And of course, when it came to naming this show, I couldn't have thought of a more appropriate name. So it's kind of an ode to George in its own way. And that's a little information you never knew. A little something you never knew about the show. So how do you like that? George Carlin is responsible for the name of this show. And guess who's responsible for bringing you this week's episode of the show? Somebody else who's very close to my heart, Dan Schlissel. Dan Schlissel, who created the incredible stand-up label known as Stand Up Records, also put out my CD, Some Kind of Comedian, available now for purchase, is proud to announce the launch of his online store at standupcrap.com. You can go there and buy downloads, and soon you'll also be able to buy CDs, vinyl records, DVDs, shirts, and a wide variety of other merchandise, direct from one of the best and most prolific comedy labels out there. Do yourself a favor and go visit www.standupcrap.com. That's standupcrap.com today. Go over there. Buy some comedy albums. Lots of great ones. Lots of guys you've heard on this show, including me. Pick up some CDs. Go do it. You know it. All right. You get the idea. Now, on to our talk, Kelly Carlin and I. Wait a second, almost forgot to tell you something. You can donate to the show. I was given 30 pairs of headphones, courtesy of Tweaked Audio. Tweaked Audio makes great earbuds. You can go to their website also and buy them at tweakedaudio.com. And you get 1/3 off at checkout when you put in promo code MDP. That stands for Modern Day Philosophers, if you didn't put it together. And you get free shipping and a lifetime guarantee. But there is a way for you to get these free, well, they're not free, but complimentary Tweaked Audio earbuds. You can go to moderndayphilosophers.net and donate to the show and keep me alive in a way. Well, that's a bit extreme, but you could keep me afloat. How about that? Go to moderndayphilosophers.net and make a donation. There's a PayPal link there. If you make a donation of $20 or more, I will ship you a complimentary pair of Tweaked Audio earbuds to your home or mailbox. Does it matter where you want? Where you tell me where to ship them. I'll ship them. Okay, now, without further ado, here's my talk with my good friend, Kelly Carlin. Hope you enjoy it. Well, the intro song, and then my talk with Kelly Carlin. Enjoy.
And welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Yes. You could just do that for an hour.
Yeah. That was an odd show. Could you make out who the guest was?
That's very funny. That's good.
With me is the wonderful Kelly Carlin, opposed to the bad one.
Yeah, that thank God that other one didn't show up today.
That other Kelly Carlin is horrible.
She's oof.
I'm glad I got you out of the Carlin compound.
You did. You got me out of the cave.
I rarely see you out of the cave.
I know.
You have such a great compound. That's the problem, I think. When you make a place too good and too livable, you don't want to leave it.
Yeah, you know, I've always been a homebody. It's who I am. Even though I want to be out in the world and have 10 right. million people know who I am and love and adore me, I'd like them to come by my house to do that.
Yeah,
they could.
I'm with you. I like
and when
that
you
too.
Say compound, like people are going to think like, you know, Spielberg, like I've got 40 acres in Brentwood or something.
No.
You know, I have
it's
like
the garage, you know, compounded with a house.
It is. Yeah. It's like, I'm lucky if I've got 2,000 square feet, basically.
Right. It just sounded better with the Carlin compound kind of rolls off the tongue.
I do. The alliteration was excellent.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I'm going to take an interruption here because I realized I always tell everyone how the show works and I forgot to tell you.
Oh, Jesus. Well, that would be helpful.
Yeah. So we just banter for like 10 minutes. Then I'll read you the bio of the philosopher.
Yes.
And then I'll give you three quotes and we read each one and then we discuss them. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go back to the
Okay, we're going back to bantering.
Yeah.
That was just kind of mid-banter.
Mid-banter.
Yeah.
It was a mid-banter break, folks. We're back.
Oh, I like that. I think that'd be a good name for a band or a festival. The mid-banter festival. I don't even know what we would have in the festival.
Yeah. With special guest Maria Bantford.
Yes, nice. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you.
God damn it. I'm going to do that. A bantering festival. Just people standing around, sitting. Maybe there's stages, audiences. Everyone's bantering.
Right.
It doesn't matter. There's no focus on anything. We're just...
Well, welcome to the bantering festival. We don't stop talking until the festival is over. We're just bantering here. Is this a real welcome? Well, it's a bantery welcome.
Is this the middle, beginning, end? It does not matter. It's all bantering. It's all bantering 24/7, people.
All bantering all the time at the banter festival.
That's basically what podcasts are. They should be called banter casts.
The banter cast.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all they really are. It's just a bunch of bantering.
Yeah.
Where the hell's that word come from? Now I need to know the etymology of that. That's
the word
be,
banter.
You know, I love the idea of this show you have here. I was thinking about doing about one for like, just do word origins, just do etymology with people and
that'd
discuss their love of words and language and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
I like that idea.
I know. Maybe we'll have to do that together.
Yeah. Oh, I'm in. Mm. I'm in. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Damn it, because we don't have enough on our plate already.
Right. Yeah. I just say yes to everything. Let's do it. All right. I'm in.
You know, it's funny. I've been saying yes the last 5 years, right after my dad died. I imagined the word yes on my forehead. Like, that's what I decided to tell the universe. Yes. Mm-hmm. Everything was yes. And now because of some... things I'm going on. One, I'm writing a book right now and have some other things set up in the future. I'm now actively learning to say no, because I really have to focus my time and energy on specific things. And so I'm unlearning the yes right now. It's very challenging for a codependent like I.
Yeah, the thing about the yes is it only holds its value if it has a no.
This is very true.
You know,
this is why you run this podcast, because you are basically a very wise man, Danny.
The no's make the yeses work.
They do. And it was fun living in the, as Rick Overton's got a great phrase, he calls it the yes field. And what he means by that is surrounding yourself by people who believe in your yes, who believe that you are the full potential of who you are. And so I've been in a yes field, and I still am in a yes field, but having to say, oh, I can't do that right now, a little part of me dies inside.
Yeah.
Because I like to be, even though I do want to be at home baking bread all the time, I do like to be in the world also.
You know, loving words, it's definitely something that runs in your family. That's,
oh, yeah.
That's genetic.
For sure. It's a Carlin, a Beery trait too. My dad's mother was the one who influenced him with that. But my dad's dad, a Carlin, Patrick Carlin, was a national award-winning motivational speech giver. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, had a love of language. But Mary Beery Carlin was really the one who really implanted the kind of the worshiping of words and the power of words.
Yeah.
She was a powerful speaker of words because she could undermine all of your self-esteem with like three or four of them.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
The power of words.
Yeah. And that's actually was, I think, the title of the speech that my grandfather used to give. It was based on a book, and I still have the book. My dad had the book that this speech was based on. It was early, early motivational speaking in the 30s and 40s. And it's like one of the earliest self-help books, which I find kind of interesting because it's something I got into in the last 10 years, getting into psychology and coaching and and leadership work and all of that. And always been fascinated with the self-help world. So it was kind of funny. I was like, oh, I'm actually walking in my grandfather's footsteps for a while.
Yeah.
It's very strange. Very strange.
Was it your dad who had that bit about self-help?
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's actually in my solo show where I talk about going to grad school to be a psychologist. And my dad's like, help.
Yeah.
What's so difficult about life? You get up, eat a good meal, take a shit, and go back to sleep and do it all over again the next day or something like that.
And it's never self-help.
It's never right. It's, you're just help. It's just help. It's just if it's self-help, you don't need it.
And that's the, that's again going back to like the wasting of words.
Yes, the preheating, the preheat, the pre-board.
Which is a recurring topic on my show because I always wonder how much of the show do I not need to say for the show to work?
Well, ultimately, we just need to sit here in silence and hold the space because that's pretty much all there is anyway. So,
which goes back to the at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
We should just do that.
Yes. Life is just one long clearing of our throats.
And everything else is banter.
Exactly. And then death. And scene.
he was born, he bantered, he died.
Pretty much it.
Yeah. Where does banter not become banter? Is banter, what if you're saying something like give me liberty or give me death? That's not banter,
that
right?
That would not be bantering. No, no. There's...
What if you threw a few more words in? Is it give me liberty or give me a burrito?
Yeah, well, I think before he said the give me liberty line, maybe that was the bantering part. He was kind of warming up the audience or something.
Yeah. In the end, they cut all the banter and you're only known for the non-banter.
Yeah, yeah, that's what gets on your headstone is the non-bantering part.
Non-bantering part.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
So you ready to jump into this philosophy?
I'm ready for the non-bantering part of the show.
Non-bantering.
Yeah.
I want to have like a sound effect. Now transitioning from banter to non-banter.
Put your seatbelt on, folks.
Welcome to the non-banter part of the show. I'm glad you stayed with us.
Thank you, yes.
Okay, the philosopher that Alex picked out for you is Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Wow.
Do you know him?
One of my probably the first encounter with a philosopher in high school. Like,
really?
Yeah, like this guy... expanded my mind.
Awesome. So you'll be able to teach me about him.
Hopefully a little bit. I mean, I haven't brushed up on him in years, but I certainly know the basics.
Emerson spoke of spirituality existing in the natural world, which is what Kelly is into too. That's your connection.
That's very nice.
So Ralph Waldo Emerson lived from May 25th, 1803 to April 27th, 1882. He was an American essayist, lecturer, and poet who led the Transcendentalist movement.
Uh-huh.
Of the mid-19th century, he was seen as a champion of individualism. Oh, I love individualism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how they mean it here, but I just love being an individual.
Yeah, pretty much. It's nice to have a body. Be separate for the rest of the matter around me.
Yeah. A prescient critic of countervailing pressures of society. And he disseminated his thoughts through dozens of published essays and more than 1,500 public lectures across the United States. Emerson gradually moved away from the religious and social beliefs of his contemporaries, formulating and expressing the philosophy of transcendentalism in his 1836 essay, Nature.
It's a good one.
You've read it?
I highly recommend it. In high school, I did. I mean, that was years ago. 10,000 years ago. And lots of bong hits ago, I might add.
That sounds like a good name for a show. 10,000 bong hits ago. The Tommy Chong story.
Yeah, I was going to say. Doug Benson's week.
Following this groundbreaking work, he gave a speech entitled The American Scholar in 1837. Emerson wrote his most important essays as lectures first and then revisited them for print. His first two collections of essays Essays First Series and Essays Second Series, published respectively in 1841 and 1844, represent the core of his thinking and include such well-known essays as Self-Reliance, The Oval Soul, The Oversoul, not The Oval Soul.
Like, he knows what shape they are?
The Oval Soul.
That's specific.
The Poet and Experience. Together with Nature, these essays made the decade from mid-1830s to the mid-1840s Emerson's most fertile period. Emerson wrote on a number of subjects, never espousing fixed philosophical tenets, but developing certain ideas such as individuality, freedom, and the ability for humankind to realize almost anything, and the relationship between the soul and the surrounding world. Emerson's Nature was more philosophical than naturalistic. Philosophically considered, the universe is composed of nature and the soul. His essays remain among the linchpins of American thinking, and his work has greatly influenced the thinkers, writers, poets, and all that have followed him. When asked to sum up his work, he said his central doctrine was the infinitude, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Infinitude of the private man. Emerson is also well known as a mentor and a friend of fellow transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau, mm-hmm. who we have discussed.
Yeah, very much influenced him, shaped his whole thinking.
He held the belief that all nature is infused with divinity. Therefore, we can only understand divinity through observing nature. Humans, that seems very Spinoza-y.
Not familiar. I know Spinoza, but not very familiar. But yeah, sounds like...
God is nature.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's not a new idea, but I think it's one he articulated well, probably.
Humans are distracted by society, and we must unplug from the other people and sit with solitude and allow nature to take us away.
I remember that there were two things we read, Nature and Self-Reliance. And I remember being a teenager who was very fascinated and felt the power of that something that one feels in nature or about life, that there's this crackling other dimension that you can't put words to, because it's beyond words. It's a sense of being at one with things. And I remember reading him and him articulating that through, you know, it wasn't necessarily, he was a deist. It wasn't necessarily a Christian. It wasn't a Christian point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't relying on the Bible to explain all of this, but that there was, he talked about that there was something infusing, and he called it divinity, I guess. And I could get behind that concept and that understanding. And then the other thing too was the self-reliance, which is about, you know, standing apart from how society wants to shape you as a person for its use. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think certainly being the daughter of my particular father, and also growing up in the era I grew up in, you know, it was the 70s and 80s, I was a teenager in the 70s. That was certainly going on in our own culture. And then my dad was a role model of that. Mm-hmm. So I think that really resonated for me in that he, you know, and then we read On Walden Pond, which, you know, talks all about that. I mean, there's this guy who supposedly leaves his, you know, town and goes live by a pond, you know, I mean, obviously mm-hmm. it's manufactured a bit, but, and finds who he is in direct connection and relationship with nature. And there's something about the power of that, that that we can recognize ourselves in nature, even though we are feel so separate from it.
It's good you didn't like rebel against your dad in a way and try and strip yourself of being an individual and blend into society.
Well, it's weird though. I mean, because, and it's something I'm writing about right now, is that in some ways, although I had that understanding of wanting to, of being an outsider, certainly feeling to an outsider. But my nature is to please people. I don't know if I got that because of my family situation and it was rather dysfunctional and we were very enmeshed and codependent as a family. So I certainly was a people pleaser in some way, which I think all entertainers really are. It's a very weird line that they walk, even my father. But I did in some ways. I mean, you know, getting a college degree was really important to me. Getting good grades was always important to me. In some ways, being rewarded by the culture is important to me, but I always did bristle against certain other aspects of that.
So in what ways was it important to be rewarded by the culture?
Well, you know, I want to be successful and have money in the bank.
Okay.
I grew up even though we were really poor when I was first born, I grew up living the American dream. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, by 1970, well, in the 60s, growing up early, we were successful. And then my dad hit it even bigger when he changed his hair and all of that around the early 70s with Class Clown and all that stuff. And we lived the American dream. I lived a very, very privileged life. I had horses and I had a new car at 16 and I had whatever I wanted. And my dad said yes to everything. And so that was my lifestyle, upper middle class lifestyle, even though my dad and mom both came from pretty working class backgrounds. But so I wanted that and I still want that. You know, you want safety and security when it comes to money. But, and I did, I enjoyed being in school and getting good grades and being part of that and being rewarded by teachers and things like that. And I wanted to be, I would have loved to have been Lily Tomlin or Carol Burnett. I mean, mm-hmm. that's who I wanted to be as a kid. Other things got in the way in my life and my choices, but it's a balance. You know, I'm always thinking, it's like writing this book right now. I get that I'm writing a memoir for you people listening out there about my life with my dad. And so, and I get that there's certain things that the publisher wants because of that. You know, they don't want me to like talk about my belly button the whole time. You know, that,
right.
Hey, what was going on with you and your dad? You know, I get that's the fucking thesis of the book. But
although that would be the connection to birth.
Right? Yeah, yes, it would definitely, for sure. I'm going back into my birth. But I also know that this book has to be what I want and need it to be also as a writer and as an artist. So it's a delicate dance all the time.
It's got to be tough in that way to sort of, going back to being an individual, there's yes. got to be that feeling of such a great shadow of your dad.
Huge. And I don't think I really realized what a big shadow it was until he died. Like I didn't really see my struggle against it. It was just kind of in the shadow.
Yeah.
It was in the periphery. And I saw myself making choices, but I never thought like, oh, that's because I'm struggling with my individuality around my dad and who I am. I just always made sure that I wasn't unconsciously or in some ugly way riding on his coattails. And I'm still doing that. I mean, it's weirder now because he's not here and there's more room for me in the world in a huge way. Immediately I felt that when he died. And this last 5 years has really been about who am I in relationship to who he was in the world and the people that find him important, you know, who mm-hmm. am I separately? And that's been this journey the last 5 years, really finding that, you know, my voice. I've always had my voice, but really seeing it as, oh, that is mine. It's separate than,
right.
It's different than his and separate. And there's some commonalities and yes, there's a nice big shoulder I'm stepping on with him, but I still need to show up,
yeah,
you know, and bring something.
I think everybody though has this on some level.
Yes.
For me, sometimes I think how much of me is my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether I want it to be or not, ultimately, forgetting even genetics.
Yeah.
It's who programs you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The environment, you know, the nurture part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as much as we all want to be individuals and we're all like, I'm me and I made me or whatever, you know, you're not. And you have to face that at a certain point. It's a tough thing to reconcile with.
It's, yeah. And yet I think it's part of being an adult is, mm-hmm. you know, seeing where you have power and where you don't have power in your life. And some things you are powerless over and a certain amount of your nature you're powerless over and a certain amount of your nurture. And then there's ways in which you do have power over those things and right. can make choices and shape differently. And then there's those, you know, you were talking about earlier about rebelling against, you know, no matter what you rebel against, you're still being controlled by it. Mm. So you're still in relationship with it.
Yeah.
So how do you not completely unconsciously succumb to something or rebel against it? But what's that, even the middle ground between that? Like what's the conscious, embracing and rejecting of all those different parts of society, family, it's the like programming.
The control group and the experiment is already set.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I really believe it's all about awareness, you know, that it's ultimately about how much are you aware of where your choices are coming from? Because it really, I mean, you know, I used to be a person who I felt very shaped by my family because I think kids who come from alcoholic drug families, you know, you feel very shaped by that dynamic. It can really do a number on you. And for years, I felt very victimized by those particular years in my family. My mother's alcoholism was out of control and my dad's drug behavior was out of control.
Just to clarify, the victimization was that you had to deal with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that I was very preoccupied with their bullshit for quite a few years and didn't have a chance to really form some aspects of myself because of that. All the attention was on them.
How much of that was a necessity and how much of it was a choice?
I don't know if you have a choice at 7 years old. I think it all feels necessity okay. because it's your security. It's your safety. It's your parents. And I was an only child too. So from like age 4 to 12, my mother's alcoholism was increasingly getting worse. And really from like age 9 to 12, my dad's cocaine addiction got crazy. So the 9 to 12 years were really, really hard. And the years before that were just weird. I don't know if it's people have like a propensity to deal with those things differently. You know, I think maybe some people wouldn't become the family referee or the psychologist or the diplomat of the family, which I became all those things.
Right. That's what I meant. Like by the choice, like you.
Yeah.
You
and I don't know where that choice comes from.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's just my nature, that I was a girl, that I was an only child. I really don't know that, but that's how it happened.
You could have gone the other way and just been totally difficult and crazy. And
I could have, yeah. And said, fuck you. The attention's coming over here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I need the attention and take care of me. But I think part of my nature is to caretake. I think that part of that is being a girl,
mm-hmm.
being a woman. And there's also something about, I don't know when you, and I would love to talk to other children of famous people, but when you're growing up in a household where there's a famous person in your midst, there's something about their needs being the only needs, that there's something about showbiz and entertainment. And maybe it happens in other kinds of, maybe it's famous judges or lawyers, I don't know. But there's something about that where the whole family, it's like we sacrifice everything for that thing.
Mm.
That's more important than us even as people. There's some sort of force of genius there or that we kind of all sacrifice ourselves to, knowing that it's needed to be in the world. I mean, all on an unconscious level, of course.
Do you think you're gravitating towards spirituality Was a rebellion as well? Because
no, both my parents were very spiritual growing up.
I remember you saying in your show, I think it was in your show, where you said you kind of had to come out as spiritual. Was that in the show, or was that something you said?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit in the show, but I felt like in general the world doesn't want to talk about these things unless it's New Agey or fundamentalist or in these other ways. But I don't know, a lot of my friends growing up and stuff were very materialistic and stuff, so there wasn't a lot of there. I didn't hang out with people who were spiritually curious. I hung out with a lot of materialists. Yeah. My parents, very spiritually curious, absolutely 100%. I got that from both my parents. You know, my dad was the one who, you know, woke me up when I was a little girl to watch the Apollo 11 moon landing. I mean, that for him was a moment like that where, wow, it's beyond the science of getting to the moon. But what does this mean? You know, he was an astronomer, an amateur astronomer. He loved the stars. He loved the fact that we were these life forms on this planet, this unlikely planet, you know, in the universe. I mean, it puts you into this big, you know, Carl Sagan cosmos kind of mind, like, wow, it's all amazing. And, so I think you look at my dad's comedy, he's a man who asks big questions about what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's about the bread, you know, why are we here? Why are we focused on that? What are we doing? What is it all about? You know,
yeah.
I think underlying his whole thesis is, you know, what's this about? Is there a reason for all of this? Now, he came to a certain conclusion later in his life where he got to be like the ultimate God and sitting outside of the kind of the solar system and watching the dance go around, right, which in itself is an interesting spiritual point of view. But yeah, I mean, you know, we had Ram Dass's Be Here Now on our table for years. And my dad was very much into quantum physics and spirituality with like, the Tao of Physics was one big book, and the Dance of the Wu Li Masters was another. It's, you know, those are two books my dad turned me on to. So I didn't feel like, I mean, spiritually, I could talk to my dad about all that stuff all the time, just because he rejected God, which I never even embraced. So mm-hmm. There was no, you know, I mean, I suppose at some point, I mean, you know, when I used to think about God, I thought possibly of a personal God sitting up there. I think as a kid you do, you think about this guy in the sky. But Emerson is a person who like woke me up from that too. It was like, oh, there's this other definition of this thing. There's this word divinity that has nothing to do with your God or my God or anything. Mm-hmm. It's that thing that makes life happen. I mean, he talks about the soul, like there's nature and soul, you know, there's like the material and there's the non-material. What is that? You know, right. I love that. Because it's, you know, I'm an agnostic because I don't know, right. You know, my dad was an agnostic. Everyone thinks he was an atheist, but he was an agnostic. I don't know. Tell me. I love the mystery of it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's a certain honesty is in not knowing.
It's huge.
You know, that I almost, if anybody says for sure they know. Even I draw a strong line between belief and knowledge. You can really believe something and you can embody a belief, but that's different than saying, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can strongly believe, but you can't know if you're honest.
Yeah. And there's objective reality, which you can test scientifically, which is what the whole Enlightenment is about. And I think a lot of what Emerson and those guys were trying to do was balance that sense of objectivity and subjectivity, mm-hmm. and that they're both allowed to exist in the world. That one, just because we have objective reality and we can test certain things, doesn't mean that subjectivity has any less purpose or power or place in the world. And that one's subjective beliefs, I think, are way more powerful than sure. material limitations on our lives. What you believe about yourself mm-hmm. shapes your life.
And we're all our own little world in a way.
Completely our own little world. So. And walking around with fucked up beliefs about the world.
Yeah.
Inside of our head that keeps us smaller than we really are. You know, our possibility is infinite. Except for we can't jump off of a 25-story building and live.
Right,
but
right.
But our possibility in other
Plus
ways.
They're very short stories.
Yeah. They're inches. They're just cute. It's a cute little building. It's just darling. But yeah, so there's, I don't know. So there's something about subjective reality that I'm comfortable in dealing with that part of the world.
And it goes back to individualism and how much of your own subjective reality is your parents and what you were raised into.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think when you were talking about being a kid and having two parents that were kind of distant, the feeling of being alone.
Yes, very lonely.
And then I wonder how much of that influences your wanting to connect to something greater and not be alone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember having a moment. I haven't written about this in the book yet. I don't know if I will or not, but I don't remember what age I was. I think it was about 9 or 10. I remember looking in the mirror one day, and it was as if I'd woken up from a dream. And I looked at myself and I said, wow, I'm really here. This isn't a dream. This isn't some movie in my head. I'm really here on earth. This is my body. This is my life. These are my parents. And this isn't pretend. This is real. And it was some sort of an awakening happened for me. And then it kind of disappeared and went away and happened a couple more times in my life. And now I kind of actively live in that space now, but it was a maturation of my brain or consciousness or what, but, and I felt less alone in that moment. Like there's like, oh, there's some knowledge here. There's some knowing of being alive and what this all is about, and that it's not just this rush of experience and, oh my God, what do I do next? And now do I want bananas or apples? And just this endless choice making or whatever. It was like this pause in all of it. And like, no, this is real. And you get to be here in a certain way if you want. Mm. I don't know. It was just a very, very powerful moment for me.
It makes sense to me when you say it. I have these moments where I try to focus in, really look at someone who is around me or something, or, you know, a tree or a dog, and not just look at it, but look at the little hairs on its face and sort of be very present with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead of just glossing over it. And there's all this information downloading constantly. And it's like, let me freeze time for a second and really appreciate that I exist.
Yep.
And that this is the time. This is when I exist.
This is it. Like, it's very. I mean, that's mindfulness. That's basically what the definition of mindfulness is: being in the moment, fully aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
because it's so easy not to be.
It's
you just
yeah.
Slide
you're kind
into,
of in you're in survival mode. Otherwise, it feels like you
yeah.
know. So it takes, and I think you know we as humans we have this extra brain part mm-hmm. of the brain up here. And that extra part of the brain gives us the ability to do that very thing, to be conscious of the moment and really aware. And so therefore, if that's partly what this brain has evolved into, I guess we should be using that more.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Raising us up above just the physical and emotional triggers.
Just sort of use it to slow down time.
Completely.
And that way we'll all achieve more immortality.
And we'll actually possibly imprint the moment in a different way, maybe into memory. I don't know. You know?
Do you think people's souls move on? Like, do you still talk to your dad as if...
You know, that's one of the mysteries. Scientifically looking at it, there's no evidence of that. There's no way to measure the energy of that. And yet, I've had some fascinating experiences with both my parents, when they both died, that I can't explain. Is it my own brain? Probably. I don't know. But, I also know that, I don't know. I mean, I've read a couple of books about people having these, interesting near-death experiences. There's some things in it that even the doctors can't explain, about it. Things they heard and saw while they were, supposedly gone in a coma.
Do you remember any of the names of those books?
Yeah, one of them is, by this, woman. It's like an Indian name. Oh, fuck. I can never, my fucking 50-year-old brain doesn't work anymore. But she, was dying of cancer and went into a coma. She was dying. The coma happened because she was dying. All of her organs were shutting down. And she was inside the coma having an experience where she could hear everything around her. She was trying to talk to people. And she could even hear conversations that were being had, you know, down a hallway corridor between doctor and husband. She could see her brother on an airplane. And she, when she woke up, she described everything that happened all around them. And from waking, and then while she was under the experience, she had this incredible healing. And when she woke up 10 days later, she was cancer free and she's still alive. I mean, it's just a freaky fucking book.
Yeah.
And the doctors, there's even parts of it where the doctors are like, they're doing, you know, they're studying her because they want to understand how did the cancer cells shut off? Because they were understanding that it's an on-off switch with these cancer cells. Mm-hmm. Somehow they got all shut off, the cancer cells. And then there's this famous one that's on the bestseller list right now, the neurosurgeon who had a brain, he was brain dead or most of his brain was gone or whatever. And he too had a full-on near-death experience where he went off and did stuff and came back. And it's like number one on the bestseller list still right now. I mean, he's a doctor too. Mm-hmm. He's the guy, you know, who's the science guy. So, but you know, I have a lot of skeptic friends and who are all into that skeptic world and everything. And they, you know, see it all as a bunch of bullshit, but mm-hmm. I don't see it as a bunch of bullshit because I don't know. I really don't know. And it gives me comfort.
And it's your subjectivity.
And my subjective reality. It's what I choose. I don't know if I believe it or not, but in the moment, I guess I'm believing it. Do I like build my life around it in some way? In some ways I do, because when I connect to the fact that, I mean, I don't, you know, it was so funny. The irony of my life sometimes makes me smile. You know, in March 2008, my dad did his last HBO show and he did a huge hunk on death. And one of the things he talked about was how your parents are not up there looking down on you, taking care of you. Mm-hmm. He talks about like the possibility of it, the reality, the odds, all of that. It's very funny. He uses his great logic to go through it all. And little did I know sitting in the audience that I'm like going, oh, I'm going to be dealing with this in 3 months. And yet, and maybe this was my own act of rebellion. I don't know. But the 2 days after my dad died, or the day after my dad died, was it the Monday? It was the Monday. I'm in my bedroom and, I suddenly have this vision, and it's more than a vision. I'm like suddenly inside of a scene, my whole being, my visual and my auditory, and I'm in the wings of a theater and where I've been my whole life watching my dad. And I look out at the stage. It's the views of the stage from the wings, and it's of a solitary microphone with a spotlight on it. And there's no one behind the microphone. And my dad says to me, "Go for it, kiddo. It's all lined up for you."
Wow.
And so I have. I've lived in the possibility and belief of that for 5 years. And it changed my life by stepping into that.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Is it true? Is it real? I don't know. But stepping into that vision and that circumstance and thinking that my dad in some way has some power to open doors for me or to tap a a person on the shoulder. And all I know is starting that day, the people and places and things that have come into my life have been miraculous on some level and amazing. And like I said earlier, I just put a yes on my forehead and said yes to it all.
Yeah.
And said, okay, what am I showing up for today? Who's coming in? What's going to happen? I like living life with that possibility.
Right.
It makes it much more fascinating and fun. And really, the universe is a friendly place because of it. I like living in a friendly universe. There's enough unfriendliness out there that I have no control over. But just, if I construct this maybe this fake friendly universe, I get shit done.
Yeah, it's just a tunnel vision of friendliness.
It is. And I get shit done. I do. I believe in life, and I, you know, care about people and want to make my art and make an impact in the world. And I can only do that if I believe that in some ways there's some friendliness going on here. Even if it's just a 1% bend.
Yeah. That's a good 1%.
It is. It's an important 1%.
People have started to hate on the 1%, but there's some decent 1%s out there.
That's right. That's
like,
right.
The milk is good.
Yeah, the 1% milk is good. Exactly. Yeah, man, what are all the haters about that? You know, poor skim milk, you know? What did it ever do to people? Yeah,
that's why it's been hiding behind 2%. Like,
yeah.
You go to the supermarket, where's the 1%?
Does that 1% really make any difference between 2 and 1%? I mean, really, people, what kind of marketing weirdness is that? It's not like you're going from 30% to 1%. It's still 2%. It's not a lot.
And then there's probably these people who are very into organics that are looking for the 1.5%
yes, milk. I only do 1.67%, actually. That's my belief system.
Very specific things that I eat and drink.
Yes.
What do you think is the link between physical health and spiritual health?
I think, I think there is a huge connection between the mind and the body. It's the same thing. You know, there's a lot of, I think one of the most fascinating things going on right now in research is consciousness research. What is consciousness? Where does the mind live? Does the mind just live in the brain? Does it live between us? Is there, you know, all of that stuff. And I think I want humanity to do well on the planet just so we can figure that shit out. You know, right. Then we're okay. Then we can go.
Then blow it up.
Then you people just do what you will do with it. But let's solve this mystery. I'm fascinated by that. And I absolutely believe there's a mind-body connection. I mean, they've shown it. I mean, emotions come from parts of the brain that dump certain chemicals into your body. And when you dump certain chemicals into your body, there's an actual physical effect to it. So, you know, I know there's a mind-body connection. The thing that drives me crazy is when people get sick and then people think, oh, well, you know, it was because she had bad thoughts about her grandmother that she has cancer in her breast now or something, whatever the fuck it is. I don't know if specific thoughts like that cause disease in your body. I doubt it. I don't think you... but I know what stress does to my body. I mean, I had an ulcer at 15, so I understand what anxiety does to the body. Mm-hmm. So there's a definite connection. The spiritual part of it is, you know, that's where you talk, where you really, you know, you're in connection with this thing that's bigger than you. I don't know. I think it's important. You know, I studied Jungian psychology, and you know, Jung is considered kind of the spiritual psychologist. He's very fascinated by soul and things like that, but really, I think he's got a great way of holding all of it, which is there's this part of the personality called the ego, which we all have to develop in order to function in the world, and not necessarily in a bad way. You know, you have to have an organized personality in order to have language and thought processes and be able to have past, present, and future and hold all those things together. So ego is really, really important. But I think that experience I had when I was a kid looking at the mirror was me realizing that I was bigger than my ego. And that's what Jung talked about in a psychological way, which is what all religions talk about, is that there's something bigger than your ego, than your personal needs, than your construct of the world. And I think that's important. I think it's important to understand that there's something bigger than the ego. Even if it's just the collective. And I don't mean that in a communistic sense. I mean the we, the thing that's created by all of us coming together. And so for me, that's what soul or spirituality means. It's that thing that is bigger. Jung called it the self, but with a big S, a capital S. That complex of itness that's bigger than this personality, this personal personality of mine. And I think it's important to sit in some sort of relationship with that every day. I think it makes us humble in a good way. And it also makes us understand that we're not in charge of everything. Our little egos think we're in charge of everything, but we're not. So I think that's important. And back to Emerson, I think that's what, I don't know, but it would seem to me that when he talks about self-reliance, he's not talking about making the ego stronger. He's talking about questioning what shapes us in our culture and in our families and how to find something deeper inside of us to help us kind of guide our way. And so I think he's talking about that thing beyond the ego.
Do you want to read some of his stuff for us?
Sure. To go into solitude, a man needs to retire as much from his chamber as from society. I'm not solitary whilst I read and write, though nobody is with me. But if a man would be alone, let him look at the stars. The rays that come from those heavenly worlds will separate between him and what he touches. One might think the atmosphere was made transparent with this design, to give man in the heavenly bodies the perpetual presence of the sublime. Seen in the streets of cities, how great they are! If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore, and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God which had been shown? But every night come out of these envoys of beauty and light the universe with their admonishing smile. Wow, what the fuck was he smoking?
It's not available anymore.
I guess not.
They took it off.
What kind of fucking kush is that? Emerson kush. I am not solitary whilst I read and write, though nobody is with me. But if a man would be alone, let him look at the stars. There's those stars again.
Yeah.
Damn stars. They're important. There's some key to them.
Because a lot of them don't exist anymore. You're looking into the past when you look at them because they're gone, right?
Yes, they are. We're seeing whatever we're seeing. Yes, we're seeing the history of them because it's, 30 right. million light years away, which, by the way, let's just parse that down. 30 million light years away means you have to go the speed of light for 30 million years. It's insane. It's insane how far away that is. That immediately makes you go, oh yeah, okay, we're nothing. We're just a speck here, which is, it makes you feel like a speck in a good way because it makes the ego crack open and go, oh, I see. I'm not the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. I feel as miraculous as that.
Isn't it crazy?
Concept.
It
is.
You can look, you can see something that far away, but I can't see something like 3 blocks from here.
Yes, that's well put. Damn it. That's very good. So it says, one might think the atmosphere was made transparent with this design to give man in the heavenly bodies the perpetual presence of the sublime. It's as if he's saying, because we're so blown away by this reality, that in itself makes us, does something to our thinking. And that you would think that maybe that's the purpose of stars, is to blow our mind.
Yeah. you can only do it at night.
Yeah.
You can only see the greater thing at night.
Yeah, you can only see the big picture at night when there's the normal goings on.
It's like during the day, you're part of the Truman Show.
Yes, yes.
At night, you get to see the cameras and everything behind the scenes.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That's, you know, that's the importance of, you know, why we have, I think, just darkness in our lives, period. You know, going through dark periods, the dark night of the soul, difficult times. Those are times when you're asked to step away from the normal goings on of this daily affairs we have. And something gets, if you're lucky, recalibrated and shifted, a different perspective comes in that then you can bring back into the daylight living. You know, it's what the hero's journey is about.
Yeah.
Ultimately, is that's the treasure that the hero brings back. I've been through this ordeal, and yet here's what I bring back: wisdom, knowledge, an understanding, a perspective, an open heart. Who knows?
And that also goes back to what you said before about understanding that it's not all random. It's all, there is some kind of a plan to it all.
Yeah, and the, you know, and that's the thing about it too. It's like the way I hold that these days is. I like to hold that there's both, that there's no plan and then there is a plan, that there is a randomness, an insane randomness to life. And yet, because of my consciousness, I can choose the meaning from it. And that for me makes it no longer random. It makes it have purpose. And that gets me out of bed every day. That's my comfort, is creating purpose from what I see around me. And it may be a subjective construct, but like I said earlier, it's okay. There's objective constructs and there's subjective constructs. And I'm not doing any harm, I don't think, with my particular subjective construct. Certainly other people have. Look at Hitler.
Yeah, yeah.
But meaning is important to me. It's essential in my life to have meaning. And, you know, it's funny because my dad was the one who taught me that. My dad was the one who looked for coins on the ground. That like meaningful, like that was meaningful. He would find a dime or something and he'd say, oh, this is good. You know, the dime. I don't know why. He found meaning. Threes. There was always threes in our lives. If we get a hotel room number that had lots of threes in it, damn, oh, this is good. We got lots of threes in the hotel. You know, it's like it's not a superstition. There's just like a pattern. You're always looking for a pattern.
Yeah, a beat.
Yeah, a rhythm. Yeah.
That's the rhythm of your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get that.
You recognize it for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were young, and I mean, you discussed the horses and the cars and all this.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find a devoid of meaning in all of that?
Yes, very much so. It was a very confusing time for me. Because I was surrounded by all this materialism and I understand the allure of it and the hit of it. I mean, it's a drug for sure. It's a drug, but in the end it leaves you so empty, so empty.
Why?
Because it's, unless it's fulfilling some real, I think the drug part of it is, and it's the part of this town that I don't like, is that it's because we put our worth and our value onto those things. We project them out and say, oh, look at the car I have. I'm worth something. Mm. Look at the people I'm hanging out with. Look at the parties I'm being invited to. Look at the clothes I have. I'm worth something because I have these. And all that really is ultimately saying is I don't feel worth unless I have those things. Mm. And so it's a lot of people with a very low sense of self-worth walking around. And people who have very low self-worth are not fun people to be around. They're very toxic and do evil shit and are greedy. And it's, you know, that's why I think I just have the heart of a fucking poet or an artist, you know, which is like some part of me would rather be starving, but, you know, writing a perfect sentence because yeah. That makes me feel alive and that feels worth something to me, on a visceral level, just on a bodily visceral level. When I write a great sentence, I feel like, life is worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's important that you went through all that just to be able to recognize it's that dark and light again.
Essential. essential to it all. Yeah, I think going through all that was, all the materialistic stuff was important because it really did show me the bullshit in this town and how to be aware of it and beware of it. And the darkness with my parents. I mean, it made me who I am, you know, and it gave me a lot of empathy and compassion for the suffering in the world and my own suffering. And it's also given me the chance to talk about things in life that a lot of people go through. And I'm lucky. I have the genetics of communicator, and I'm a person who knows how to put sentences together and describe things in a way that is illuminating. Yeah. And if I can use that to let people go, oh, I'm not so alone, I've went through that too, then hell, you know, that's great, because we're kind of all lifting each other up here. You know, what else do we have?
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Want me to read the quotes?
Yes, please.
Nobody can bring you peace but yourself. What's your take on that?
Nobody can bring... Well, I guess it comes back to, like, everything comes from within you. It's that moment that you had with the mirror, almost, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that you really do construct. You can construct your chaos or your peace, you know? And those of us who are lucky enough, who the chemicals in our brains are balanced enough that we can construct the peace. Because I know what it feels like to have chaos inside me too. I had panic disorder for many years. But then again, it took my own mind to get me out of it, to teach me how to test the chaos, that the chaos wasn't real. It was just in my mind. So truly, that is very, very true. Yeah, it's so weird because that, you know, they have this study where they've talked about wealth, making a certain amount of money, and they have found that severe poverty is, there's a lot of unhappiness, but then you get to a certain amount of money in your life and a certain level of happiness happens. And then more money on top of that does not add more happiness. So it just goes to show that circumstance is important for on some level for peace, but not as much as we think it is.
Yeah.
You know, at least when it comes to money, you know, I mean, health has something to do with that too, but,
it's all about knowing how much money to ask for.
Exactly. It's that sweet spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a friend who I went on retreat for a couple of days before the end of the year. And, she asked this beautiful question at the beginning of the retreat, which is, how much pleasure or joy could you dare to let yourself feel?
That's
and
a
it's
good one.
Now a question I ask myself every single morning, because I'm a kind of person who wakes up in the morning in a semi panic all the time. Jesus Christ, what the fuck? What's somebody doing? What are we doing? Who wants me? What kind of emails? What do we need?
Yeah.
I'm kind of in alarm mode when I wake up.
Yeah.
And now I've been like, so how much joy
could
I possibly allow myself to feel in this moment?
Well, that's a good question.
It's a huge, huge life-changing question, I believe. So how much peace could you allow yourself to feel right now too? That would work too. The next quote is, a man is what he thinks about all day long.
What he thinks about? I always think it's more about your actions than your thoughts.
Yeah, and yet where do your actions come from but your thoughts?
Right.
Your thoughts construct your reality.
I guess so, unless like if you're dealing with an addict who's fighting addiction, you might still be thinking about doing drugs but not doing them.
That is very true. There is a new thought he's having, though, which is, I can do without that today.
The competition between rational thinking and desire.
And yeah, and that physical urge or that very unconstructive thinking that goes on. Yeah. One of the things that I've been finding that's helped me with this book is, this phrase just like entered my head when I started writing, which is, you can do this. And so on days when I wake up and I think, oh man, how am I going to do this chapter? I don't know. Or you don't know, but you're creating something. I just have this mantra. I can do this. I can do this. You can do this. You can do this, Kelly. You can do this. You know what you're doing. Come on. You can do this. It'll come. And it does. It's funny. It is. A man is what he thinks about all day long. So beware of your thoughts. Be aware and beware, because they are constructing your reality. Because we think fucked up shit in our heads about ourselves. Oh my God, or the world. Never lose an opportunity of seeing anything beautiful, for beauty is God's handwriting. I always hate it when the word God ends up in a sentence, because it's such a triggering thing, you know, instant triggering. Like, well, which God does he mean? And is he a God person? And do I have to think about his God? And what if I don't believe in God? And what is that fucking word? And I hate that. But it's that thing that's bigger than us. That's the way I hold it. You know, I mean, if it is all accidental, and there's a lot of beauty in the world, you know, when you look at like those National Geographic pictures and in nature documentaries, and you think, wow, look at the way the sand just does that thing. And there's so much beauty in the natural world. And even if it is all accidental, we recognize it. It does something to us when we look at it. It viscerally, you know, the difference between looking at something beautiful and ugly, there's a physical reaction. And maybe it's something about that since we have the ability to see beauty, and it's like I said earlier, you know, how much beauty are you willing to see today in the world?
There it is. And then you'll think about it, and then you'll become it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you'll look for it more, you know, and then you'll find beauty in everything. That's what I love about, that's my spirituality, finding beauty in everything. There is beauty in everything, even in the strangest ugliness of it all. It's a beautiful dance.
It's funny how we relate to nature as being more beautiful than things that are sort of man-made.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if funny is the word, but it's definitely something to make you think, because I think when I look at like a catalog of stuff, like the nicer stuff is the stuff that resembles nature more.
Yeah. There's something about it aesthetically that does that thing inside of us, whatever
wood,
it is.
The wood table that's clearly real wood.
Yeah.
Opposed to the compressed wood. Why do we care?
Yeah. Right.
Because it's like more nature. Give me more nature in my house.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I wonder if we just, there's something about the molecules that we resonate with or something that, does that for us. There's a language going on between our nature and nature, which I think is true. Have you read Wendell Berry?
No.
Check him out. Maybe he might be a good subject for your show here. He's a farmer, but he's alive, but he's very much about the importance of man connecting to nature.
Just even looking at this desk, this is compressed wood.
Yeah.
But it's got a fake thing on top of it to make it look like it's real wood.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's something about in the, that we recognize in it that makes us calm. But then there's another part of us goes, yeah, but this isn't the real wood. Thing.
Get this fake nature out of here.
Yeah.
It's not in my nature.
It's why I'm fascinated by men who love really fake boobs. I'm always like, really? It's so not.
And they're more disconnected, those people too.
Yeah. It's weird because it's a primal urge to connect to the breast.
Yeah.
For men and for women too. But there's this primal thing going on. And so it's as bottom line nature as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the fake ones are so strange. And yet because they have this kind of symmetry roundness to them, they trigger some part of the brain. I don't know. It's fascinating.
You know what? I think it goes back to what you were saying about materialism and the evil in materialism.
Mm.
And you ever notice it's the guys with the fast, shiny cars and everything that have the wives with the fake
emptiness.
Boobs.
Right. There's all a bunch of emptiness inside these people.
And it is a disconnect from nature, because it's like, okay, I want to get to the boob, but let's put an obstacle between me and it. Let's just, as much as we can, block nature.
Yeah.
Like, these guys don't live in the mountains.
Well,
and And
yeah, because I think there's also a basic terror of nature, because we can't control it. It is bigger than us. And so there's humans, I think, I mean, look at how we have shaped the world. We have done everything we can to separate ourselves. We've got a little bit of nature.
Little patches.
Little patches. There's a tree. There's a little bush.
Yeah.
But we can control that. It's the uncontrolled nature that reminds us that we are just little squishy little ants or something here. And
it's the difference between fighting it and being at one with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like a fight. This block is cement and everything. This is a fight. These are like the barriers, like keeping nature in its little cages, these gates.
Yep.
These lawns. It's like
keeping the human nature, that the base human nature beyond the gate or something. Yeah, it's
I guess that's the term plastic, when people are like, "Oh, it's all plastic. It's like plastic." Like let's take it back to your dad. You can't talk about plastic. I can never talk about it without thinking about that.
It's true.
But plastic is the opposite of nature. And if nature is spirituality and nature can be called godliness, then plastic is the opposite, right?
It'll be our downfall as a species, I feel, the plastic in some way. Yeah, it's our ultimate barrier against nature. And it's the difference between rejecting what scares us versus embracing it.
And being at one with the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. People, the ultimate fear of death and going back into the ground and saying, all right, what if we surround ourselves with plastic, then ground can't have us.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's Walt Disney, right?
Yes. Yeah.
This was a good eye-opening talk.
This is fun. This is great.
Thank you for doing it.
My pleasure.
I can't wait to read the book. And when it comes out, we'll let everybody know.
Yeah, it'll be a long time away, but end of 2015, but yeah.
Yeah, but if you look at the stars, it's nothing.
Nothing.
It's nothing.
30 million light years, people.
Compared to a star, this book is already out.
Are you kidding? Yeah, there's people in other galaxies have already read it.
Yeah, and they loved it on Amazon.
They gave it 5 stars.
I was waiting for it. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Modern Day Philosophers. Thank you again to Kelly Carlin for doing the show. I want to remind you, you can go to www.moderndayphilosophers.net and make a donation of $20 or more. I still have 29 pairs of Tweaked Audio headphones to give away, and one of them can be yours. So you can do that. Go to standupcrap.com. Like I said, pick up a copy of my album, Some Kind of Comedian, or go get something from Brendan Burns or Lewis Black or Mark Maron. They're all up there. Lots of good stuff. And join the Facebook page, facebook.com/moderndayphilosophers. I post up photos every week from my interviews. You can check out what I look like on a week-to-week basis, or just if you're more interested in the guest, I would assume that would be more of an appeal. You can see what the guest looks like and see us talking philosophy. That's always fun. Real action shots we got up there, folks. But we also post lots of other stuff, quotes from the philosophers and links, and go check out the Facebook page. And if you do feel so inclined and you have the time and you want to be generous with it, you can always go to iTunes, leave me 5 stars and a nice comment. That goes a long way to help the visibility of the show on iTunes. So there's always that. Thank you, everybody, again for tuning into the show, and I'll be back with another one next Monday. Hope you're all doing well and have a great week. Bye-bye.